end of the last class, we just introduced this concept called eternal inflation, which we didn't quite get there, but we almost did. So this was motivated by comparing the typical size of these stochastic jumps that were induced through the quantum fluctuations. So I have some patch. Remember, I'm sitting in this patch. And there's some scalar field, V of phi. And classically, if in the past I started at some point up on the potential, then as I go forward in time, I would just see the scalar field decrease as it rolls down the potential, and the energy density decreases, and I get this picture of slow roll inflation. Yeah? But then on top of this classical rolling, there's also this stochastic noise that has to do with the quantum fluctuations in the field. And so as I evolve, I don't see this completely deterministic rolling down the potential, but in fact, I see this sort of biased random walk. Okay. And that biased random walk was described by the Langevin equation. And the relevant thing, so the thing to compare is the typical size of these quantum jumps, okay? And the distance that I roll in roughly one Hubble time. Okay. So I compare the distance that I go typically through one of these quantum fluctuations and the distance that I roll in one Hubble time. And that quantity turned out to be P zeta to the 1/2. So this amplitude of the power spectrum that we learned about in the first part of the class, which again, just to remind you, was V to the 3/2 over M Planck cubed times the magnitude of the slope. So let's look at this potential and ask where this occurs. Okay, so there's a number of relevant scales that we can identify on this potential. Let's say we had V 1/2 m squared phi squared. So one important scale was this slow roll parameter, which told me if I got inflation at all. So this was 1/2 V prime over V squared. And for chaotic inflation, this 1/2 m squared phi squared potential, epsilon V is 1 when phi is square root 2 m Planck. So if you shove that in, take that derivative, you will find that epsilon is 1 when phi is root 2 m Planck. Okay, so there's some point on this potential where phi is root 2 m Planck. Above this value for the field, I get slow roll inflation. Below it, I don't have slow roll at all. So I have this slow roll region on the potential. Okay. And then there's another scale which I can identify by looking at where P zeta equals 1. Okay. So that's when I enter this regime of stochastic eternal inflation. Okay, that's when the quantum fluctuations dominate the classical drift. And we can solve for that. So let's shove that in here. So we're going to have V to the 3/2 over M Planck V prime. So I get a M squared to the 3/2. That's M cubed. Phi squared to the 3/2. That's phi cubed. I've got an M Planck cubed, excuse me. And then I've got V prime, which of course is just M squared phi. Yeah. So we can cancel some things. This is equal to M times phi squared over M Planck cubed. And we want to know for what value of phi, we'll call it phi eternal inflation, this equals 1. Okay. Well, that's easy enough to solve for. So phi eternal inflation is equal to m Planck to the 3 halves divided by m to the 1 half, which is more conveniently written as a ratio of these scales times m Planck. Okay? And since m is going to be less than m Planck, then this number is much bigger than m Planck. Yep. So I have some region on this potential. Roughly here, where phi is m Planck over m to the 1 half m Planck, where I enter this regime of slow roll eternal inflation. Okay. So when I'm up here, I'm in this stochastic regime where the quantum fluctuations dominate. Okay, so let me make a simple point. As I go up this potential, there's some points where p zeta is roughly 10 to the minus 9. Okay, that's what we see in the CMB. So if this really is the model of our universe, there's some point here where p zeta is roughly 10 to the minus 9. Okay. So what's a logical thing for the field to have done before this time when the scales produced in the CMB were formed? Well, it was probably a little bit further up the hill, because things classically like to roll down the hill. And if I extrapolate that back in time, then a fairly logical possibility is that our universe came from further up the hill from a time when you were exhibiting this phase of slow roll eternal inflation. So this is motivated because things like to roll down the hill. So you might care about this as a possible epoch of the early universe, like for real, something that actually happened in our early universe. Okay, so these are the relevant scales. And now, so I've given you this qualitative picture. Let's do something quantitative, and let's write down a toy model of eternal inflation. So during the tutorial yesterday, I hope you got some sense for what this concept is. It's basically like a phase transition that doesn't like to complete. Okay, so you have this universe that keeps multiplying, and you can end inflation, but it doesn't have to end everywhere if the probability for ending inflation is low. So before I go to the toy model of eternal inflation, are there any questions on this, or any questions that came up yesterday during the tutorial on these sort of general concepts? Okay, so you guys all understand this.
Yep.
That is a fantastic question. That is the area of active research. Actually, that's one of the things that I do in my research. So what you can look for is some evidence of the primordial inhomogeneities that are caused due to this violent fluctuation of the geometry, right? So this p zeta is order 1. And that means that you really have these huge differences between different places of the universe. And if that's in our past, then it's possible that those huge fluctuations could be imprinted. Although the downside is that anything that was produced at an early time, as we learned, it corresponds to a very long wavelength. Okay, so you need to get, in a sense, have a more specific scenario. So maybe I'll mention, actually, in one of the last classes, a way that you could possibly test this idea. But that's definitely an area of active research. Okay. So let's discuss a toy model of eternal inflation. Okay. And to illustrate this toy model, I'm gonna show you another piece of formalism, okay, which is completely equivalent to the Langevin approach that we talked about yesterday. But it aims to directly compute rho of phi of t. Okay? So there was this probability distribution for the trajectories that we derived using the Langevin equation. So the Langevin equation told us about specific trajectories, and then we calculated the moments of those trajectories to figure out the probability distribution. And we can use something called the Fokker-Planck equation to directly compute this probability distribution. Okay. This is important in various areas of physics. So again, if you want to make $1 million in finance, people use this. If you're interested in condensed matter physics, this formalism is also quite important. This is a pretty key set of concepts in like molecular dynamics, where you're interested in what happens in a gas. So anyways, what is this equation? Well, you can derive from the Langevin equation the following. So this is given without proof. If you're interested in seeing a proof, I can show you, or I can point you to a reference where it's done. It's not short, so I couldn't present it in the class, but suffice it to say there is such a proof. So h is just the Hubble constant, which is, we're assuming v of phi over 3 m Planck squared. Okay, so we're in the slow roll regime. That was an assumption that went into the Langevin equation. That's an assumption that goes in here. And we're going to choose a particular potential for the scalar field that's really, really simple. So our choice for V of phi is something that's flat between big phi and negative phi, and it takes some value. We'll call that value V naught, and it's zero everywhere else. So when I'm up here, h is positive. You'll excuse me, that was squared. H is positive, and for the same reasons as we've been discussing, I get inflation. Okay, so I get, if I have a constant vacuum energy, an inflating universe. Down here, I don't have inflation because h is zero. Okay. So we're going to assume that inflation ends when the magnitude of phi gets bigger than big phi. And when that happens, we're going to assume that I have absorbing boundary conditions, okay? Meaning that this probability density is going to go to zero when I get to the boundary. This is equivalent to having walls of the box at big phi and minus big phi that just absorb any kind of probability current. So that's a boundary condition. Of course, I have a differential equation, which is why I need a set of boundary conditions. And because dv d phi is zero, I can forget about that term, and I just have to contend with this term over here. Okay. So we can solve this equation minus that last term. Always do that. So we can solve this by separation of variables. So we're going to assume that rho is some function of t times some function of phi. And if I put that into this equation and I divide by fg, what I'll find, and this is just the same way you'd go about solving, say, the Schrodinger equation, is that 1 over f, yeah? Because in this case, v is flat everywhere. So dv d phi is everywhere 0. Any other questions? Okay. So the left-hand side, if I divide by 1 over fg, becomes 1 over f df dt. And the right-hand side becomes h cubed over 8 pi squared 1 over g d squared g d phi squared. Now, one extremely annoying thing about my handwriting is that my partial derivatives always look like total derivatives, which means I get to totally cop out, and you guys decide. But these are total derivatives, because these are just functions of t and phi, respectively. OK. And for these two sides to be equal, they both have to be equal to some constant, right? That's the typical way we solve this system of equations. And I need to satisfy that boundary condition, that rho at big phi and minus big phi is 0. And in ansatz for a solution that satisfies those boundary conditions is just g equals cosine of some integer m times pi phi over 2 big phi, where m is odd. So you can check that when m is odd, we get cosine of plus minus pi over 2 times an integer at big phi. So we solved the boundary condition. OK. So we can shove that into the right-hand side. And what we learn is that c is equal to minus m squared, where m is this integer, over h cubed times 32 big phi squared. Okay. That just came from taking the second derivative of this cosine and canceling a few factors of pi. Yeah. OK, so now I have this equation, which we all know how to solve. Df dt equals negative m squared h cubed over 32 phi squared times f, where f is just a function of t. And the solution to this equation is, of course, an exponential. So f is equal to some constant times e to the minus m squared h cubed over 32 phi squared times t. So this is the general solution if I take this times cosine, okay? And in general, I can have any linear combination of this general solutions for any m, right? So the most general solution that I have is rho equals the sum over all m, where I restrict m to be odd, times am e to the minus m squared h cubed over 32 phi squared t times cosine of m pi phi over 2 big phi. So that's the most general solution. And you'll see that I need another boundary condition. I need to tell you what rho is at t equals 0. So let's assume that rho at t equals 0 is just delta phi, the Dirac delta function. So initially, all the probability is at phi equals 0. Okay, and this is a probability density. So when I integrate it, rightfully, I get 1. Integral of the delta function is 1. OK, so this implies that these coefficients are just equal to phi inverse, because the delta function can be represented as an infinite sum of cosines. So that gives me the most general solution for rho with this boundary condition. So that's rho. And if I restrict myself to large t, then you can see that because I have this exponential, the m equals 1 term falls off more slowly than the m equals 3 term, which falls off more slowly than the m equals 5 term. Okay, so in this sum, the m equals 0 term is going to dominate in the large t limit. M equals 1. Sorry, I don't know why I said 0. Okay, so at large t, rho is given by phi inverse times this cosine pi phi over 2 phi e to the minus m squared h cubed over 32 phi squared t, where that's 1, excuse me. Okay, so this at large t is the solution. And now I can calculate the total probability to stay on the plateau. That is, to remain inflating. This we'll call p. And p is just the integral from negative phi to phi of rho phi d phi. And at large t, that's given by this, so I can shove that in and calculate this. So this is equal to big phi inverse. And then I have the integral from negative phi to phi of cosine pi phi over 2 phi d phi times this exponential. Okay, and that integral is not hard. That's just 4 phi over pi. And for p, I will just end up with 4 over pi e to the minus h cubed t over 32 phi squared. So this is the probability to stay on the plateau. And any region of the universe that remains on the plateau is undergoing inflation. Now I can think of this probability to stay on the plateau as being equivalent to the fraction of co-moving volume on the plateau. So if I start with some piece of the universe, and I draw a picture in terms of co-moving volume, it's going to look exactly like this simulation that you guys played with yesterday. So at t equals 0, it looks like this. At t equals 1, the universe has grown, so it has these 4 different patches. At t equals 2, it gets more patches, etc., right? And certain regions end up stopping inflation, and other regions remain inflating and keep dividing. So if this is the fraction of co-moving volume on the plateau, then I can find the total physical volume that remains on the plateau. or the total physical volume that remains inflating, and that's just going to be P times e to the 3ht. Okay. Because for every cell that I have that's still in the plateau, every doubling time I get e to the 3 more.
Anymore, it's a little bit, because you see that the squares are the same size, but when you go to physical volume, you cannot change it in the same way, right? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. Here, you do have to worry about that in general. Here, it doesn't so much matter, because you can think about the regions that have stopped inflating as just subtracting out the equivalent amount of comoving volume. So that if I'm just interested in the volume that's still inflating, I can think of this as just pieces removed. And that subtlety kind of gets swept under the rug. But that's a good question. So I've got this e to the 3ht, and then I've got this other exponential, so let's combine them. So that the answer I get in the end is 4 over pi times e to the 3 minus h cubed over 32 phi squared times t. Wow, that's odd. If this exponential is positive, then the total physical volume just increases without bound as time goes on. If the exponential is negative, then the total physical volume goes to zero. And that's eternal inflation. So this is important enough for its own board. So 4 h squared over 32 phi squared bigger than 3, then the physical volume increases to infinity. Yeah? This never stops. So if I keep going further and further in time, I keep making more and more inflating space. And even though there are regions of the universe that end up falling off this plateau, it just doesn't fall off fast enough to compete with the exponential expansion of space. And this, again, more quantitatively, is eternal inflation. And this criterion is the same as the one we described above, effectively. Just in a much simpler model. So the same thing occurs in a general model when p zeta is bigger than 1. You get the same runaway reproduction of volume.
Is it in this way or the other way around?
Yeah. Cheers. Surprisingly hard to get the inequalities and minus signs right when you're up on the board. You'll learn that. Okay. So we'll come back to this a little bit at the end of the class. But this is really the consequence. Whenever I have such a model, it predicts that the total volume of the universe is in fact infinite. That's pretty bizarre. But this just arose from all the standard assumptions that went into making the density perturbations that we see in the CMB. So it's on roughly equal footing. Okay, so that's basically all I had to say about slow roll eternal inflation. So if you have questions, please ask me now. You guys aren't shocked that the total volume of the universe is infinite? This isn't like total crap to you. Okay. It's pretty cool stuff. It's pretty bizarre. Okay. If there are no objections, then we will move on. So let's erase. So the next thing that I told you we'd talk about is vacuum decay in quantum field theory. And this secretly is just another way of making the field fluctuate, but this time the field is going to fluctuate in a much more dramatic manner. So again, it's all about the vacuum, right? We spent most of this class trying to define what we mean by the concept of a vacuum when I have curved space-time. So in quantum field theory, what do? Well, typically, we do perturbation theory. So for example, in your particle physics class, you probably learned that we usually write the interactions for some field. We have 1/2 m squared phi squared, just a massive free field, plus small, right? So this could have been something like phi to the fourth or something else. But the point was that you're doing an expansion around the free field theory. Okay. And inflation basically does the same. So I have some classical solution. And more or less what I'm doing is the classical solution plus small. Right? So I have these density perturbations. The eternal inflation story I told you about is somewhat of a counterexample to this, but it's motivated by the same idea, where I have some classical solution, and then I make a small expansion around that classical solution, and basically I just do perturbation theory. Okay, so that's all nice and good. We know how to do that. But what about this? So here, on the left, I've got something that looks sort of like this, right? So I could imagine doing perturbation theory around this minimum. Okay, that's certainly valid. I could do that. But what do we know about quantum mechanics? Well, quantum mechanics tell us that, say I had some wave packet, it can feel what's on the other side of the barrier. So there must be something more to this than just perturbation theory. So quantum mechanics tells us we should probe the other side. And if this was really one-dimensional quantum mechanics, of course, what you tell me is that there's this phenomenon called quantum tunneling, right? So if I tried to stick a particle here, then there's some finite probability that when I make a measurement at a later time, I find the particle over here. Okay. So what does that mean for quantum field theory? Well, if I'm in flat space, it would be absurd to think that I could just tunnel everywhere at once, because that would cost an infinite amount of energy, right? So if the whole universe was localized here and I'm doing this nice perturbative expansion around this point, I shouldn't expect that all of a sudden the whole universe ends up over here, because that simply would cost an infinite amount of energy. So instead, what happens is you can realize that we're talking about a field, okay? And a field can take different values at different points in space. So while I can't probe the other side of the barrier everywhere at once, I can probe it locally. So I need two labels. Let's call the, when the field is sitting here, it's at A. And when the field is over here, it's at B. A corresponds to in the barrier. B corresponds to out of the barrier. I could, for example, draw a configuration in real space. This is really position X and Y, where the field everywhere on the outside is A, but inside some local region, it probes the other side of the barrier, B. Okay? And this should be familiar to you. This is how a lot of phase transitions in nature happen. So for example, when I boil a pot of water, the whole pot of water doesn't instantaneously turn into steam. It forms little bubbles of steam, and then those bubbles slowly convert the water into steam. It doesn't happen all at once. And so we'll see that because of something like this, the universe, in a sense, boils, and it even boils at zero temperature. Great. So that's going to be the next three lectures. We're going to learn how the universe boils even at zero temperature. So I really wanted to do this experiment for you guys, but it just didn't work. If you go on YouTube, you can find all these videos, and I encourage you to try this in your own home freezer. If you get yourself a bottle of water and you stick it in the freezer for about 3-4 hours, it's important that it's distilled water. You stick it in the freezer for about 3-4 hours, you pull it out, you'll find that it's still liquid, okay? But the temperature is below freezing of the water. So the water is in a metastable state. Now take that bottle, slam it on the table, and it will turn to ice in less than a second. So this is a similar concept. I have a more or less super-cooled universe that's just waiting for some fluctuation to induce a phase transition, and in this case, it's a quantum fluctuation that does it. Okay. Yeah, so this is really a bubble of B in a C of A. So inside of this bubble, the field takes a value which is on the other side of that potential barrier, whereas outside the bubble, I'm in the region of that minimum. So locally, I tunnel here to B, but not everywhere.
So, another question. Mm-hmm. So the difference with what we did before is that here, A is a false value, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, A is a false value. So we want to know, beyond perturbation theory, what happens in quantum field theory. Okay, in order to get there, show of hands, how many, have you guys done the path integral formulation of quantum mechanics at all? Okay. Okay, so let me do a real lightning review of that then. So I should warn you, things are about to get a bit technical, but just remember that this is where we're headed. So in about a lecture, we'll get there. Okay, so if I just have, and by the way, we'll do this in 1D quantum mechanics first. So forget about field theory for the moment, we're just doing quantum mechanics. So if I have some particle, and I know it starts at some time t at xi, and some later time it's at xf, then there's some classical trajectory, we'll call it x bar, that a particle would take to go between xi and xf. But what the path integral formulation tells us to do is in fact not just consider the classical trajectory, but every possible trajectory that connects xi and xf. So that if I want to calculate a quantum mechanical amplitude, so this is the propagator in one-dimensional quantum mechanics. It tells me how to evolve states. I start in some state where I'm at xi, and I end in some state where I'm at xf. This is equal to some normalization factor times the sum over all paths of e to the I times the action divided by h bar, where since we're doing one-dimensional quantum mechanics, the action is just an integral from and to be consistent, we'll say that this is time t negative big T over 2, and this is time big T over 2. That's just an arbitrary choice, but to be consistent with what I'll write later. And this is 1 half times dx dt squared. So I'm assuming the mass of this particle is just unity, minus v dt. So the prescription is I just calculate the action for every possible path that you can imagine, sum them up, and then I get the right answer for this amplitude. Sounds crazy, but we're going to do that. Okay, so the relevant facts that we need to know about the path integral are the following. So first, x bar of t just comes from setting the variation of the action with respect to x bar, to x, excuse me, equal to 0, right? Which, just to remind you, that thing in here is, of course, the Lagrangian. This is just the Euler Lagrange equations, right? So this is just dl dx ddt dl dx dot equals 0. And those are really partial derivatives. So because of that, you'll notice that the action, when I evaluate it in the vicinity of the classical path, doesn't change by very much. It's a stationary point. So around x bar, s doesn't really vary. Okay? And so that means when I perform this sum, basically all the paths that are in the vicinity of the classical path add coherently, right? It's like I'm adding up a bunch of sines and cosines, but they have the same phase and the same frequency. If I added up a bunch of incoherent sines and cosines, I'd probably get 0. So around the classical path, S doesn't really vary. So that means that X bar gives the largest contribution to this sum over paths. So so that's one-dimensional quantum mechanics. That's basically the salient facts about the path integral that we'll need. And I'll just mention briefly that there's also a path integral formulation for fields in quantum field theory. That's what we'll be doing later. And in this case, what it means is I take some configuration of the field, And I find the amplitude to transition to another configuration of the field, right? This is phi of x. So this is really like some spatially varying field configuration. And this is equal to an integral over all possible field configurations, again, times e to the I s over h bar. So this is also equally well defined for quantum field theory. Brief aside. I'm already on board. I think I write at least 5 times bigger than you because I seem to use at least 5 times as many boards. Okay, so now we're going to try and actually evaluate the path integral. Okay, did you guys get a chance to actually evaluate the path integral for any systems yet? Maybe, yeah? Okay. Okay, so maybe this is reviewed. Did you do the harmonic oscillator? No? Okay. Then we'll see that. Okay. So we're back to 1D quantum mechanics. And a very useful trick is to go to imaginary time. And this isn't going to give us imaginary answers about imaginary systems. It's going to give us answers about real systems. So it's just really a mathematical trick. Okay. So what we're going to do is in every expression that we write, we take t to minus I t or I tau, where tau is this imaginary time. Okay. So that means this amplitude that I wrote up there is really e to the minus ht over h bar. Okay. That came from putting a minus I in the big T. Xi. This is going to be a normalization times the sum over all Euclidean paths now that connect x initial to x final times e to the minus s, where inside s I've taken t to minus I tau over h bar. So there's no I anymore here. Okay, this is just a sum over real exponentials. And now this Euclidean action is an integral over d tau times 1/2 dx d tau squared plus v. Okay? So the difference between this Euclidean action and the Lorentzian action that I wrote up there is that v goes to minus v. So that's basically the change in the action. So v has gone to minus v. So let's look at the left and right-hand sides of this expression separately and ask a little bit about what they mean. So on the left-hand side, this Hamiltonian is still the same Hamiltonian that I had for my original system. And that Hamiltonian has a set of eigenstates labeled by n, say. Okay, so this is still some eigenvalue problem. And these are the same eigenvalues for the real time problem. So what that means is that this propagator can be written as a sum over e to the minus en t over h bar. Okay, this just came from the standard solving this eigenvalue problem, sticking it in for h, and expanding in a complete basis of states, which you've probably seen before. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, there's this e to the minus en t over h bar. And so that means that if I take t to infinity, this sum is dominated by the ground state, the state with the lowest energy. Yeah? Okay, so that's a kind of cool thing that we learn about the left-hand side of this equation. So what about the right-hand side? Okay, so on the right-hand side, let's promote this sum over paths to some integral over all functions x of t. And this integral, of course, has a boundary condition, so there are some limits of integration. So remember that we are requiring that x at minus t over 2 is xi, and x at t over 2 is xf. Okay, so this is all functions that meet this set of boundary conditions. Okay, so any questions so far? Okay. We'll charge ahead. So let's write any function x of tau as the classical path that I would get by solving the Euler-Lagrange equations plus a sum over n times coefficients times some orthogonal set of functions, okay, which we'll label xn, where these xn evaluated at plus or minus t over 2 are 0. Okay. Further, let's, as I said, impose orthogonality so that if I integrate from negative t over 2 to t over 2 d tau of xn xm, I get delta nm. Okay? So there's some orthogonality condition on these functions that I've chosen. So with this definition, I can define a measure for the path integral. That is, I can define a way of integrating all possible functions. So this abstract symbol can now be written as a product over integrals of these coefficients, okay? And I need to normalize this. A convenient normalization is to divide by 2 pi h bar to the 1 half, okay? This gives me some sense for how far away from the classical path that I'm getting. You can measure that in terms of h bar because the relevant thing in the path integral is comparing the action h bar, right? Okay, that's good. So that's my definition, and let's solve the Euler-Lagrange equations, which is easy enough, and we all know the answer. It's just the equation of motion for a particle of unit mass. So this is dx d tau squared plus v prime equals 0. Okay, from this you get x bar as a function of tau, imposing the boundary conditions that it's at xi at negative t over 2 and xf at plus t over 2. Yep. Okay. Since I only have 5 minutes, do you guys mind if I move over here instead of erasing? Yeah. Okay. Can you all see? Yeah. I'll move to the front. Okay. 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 So now we can take this propagator, or amplitude, excuse me, and write it using that integral, okay? So this is this normalization factor times this product of integrals over these coefficients times e to the minus s Euclidean over h bar. Okay. And now what we can do is we can try and look at paths that are close to the classical path. Did y'all have a question? Or no? Okay. Any other questions before I charge on? Okay. Okay. So this is what we have here. The next thing we're going to do is tailor expand around x bar. Yeah. You know what? There's not enough time to do that. So why don't we pause here, and I'll start with that next time. But now you guys have a few minutes to ask me anything you ever wanted to know about eternal inflation, or inflation, or path integrals, or bubbles, or tunneling, anything you want to know? So how many of you believe, show of hands, that the universe is actually infinite in extent? No one. Okay, show of hands. How many believe that that there was a Big Bang and the universe had a definite moment of time when it came into being? One? Okay. All right. All right, show of hands. How many people believe inflation? That this is actually part of the story of the real world? Okay, that's pretty good. So at least the first half of the class was pretty convincing. okay, well, that's good. So if there are no other questions or no other polls that anyone would like to raise, why don't we save this for Monday? Okay, great, see you then.